Hello. Welcome to another episode of the Telltale Heart, a Cardiovascular Digest for Pharmacists. Welcome back. I know we have missed our two-week cadence for episodes. That is partly because I think it is summer vacation and everyone is busy and things are going on, and I have had things going on, so I know we're a little off cadence. I had a different episode slotted and the person had an emergency come up and we canceled, but it's actually worked out serendipitously because the guest today has had a very timely and critical and I think important paper to talk about that was published in Circulation, the Journal for the American Heart Association. It's American Heart Association Scientific Statement. So we'll get to that here in a second. But again, always, if you like our content, please like, subscribe, follow, give us feedback. We continue wanting to grow and change this and add, and really do look for feedback and interest for this. That being said, I'm going to transition straight into our guest today, and I'm not being mysterious. He's actually been on the pod before, and he's returning, but now he's returning not to talk about trials and meeting coverage. He's here to talk about his paper that he led as one of the chair authors of this hot topic right now in terms of scientific statements. And I don't think when he and the team, and he can tell us this, set out to do this, that actually this conversation would become very germane in the world of healthcare policy. I'm going to welcome, Dr. Rob DiDomenico. How are you, Rob? Good to see you again or hear
I'm well.
You. And
I'm well. Thanks, Craig. I appreciate the invite.
No, Rob, I am so excited to have you on the podcast today because you're going to be talking to us about a topic that has been around for forever. I think it's gained a lot of traction in the last several years. I know I've spent some time when I was busy with the ACC doing work with the geriatric section related to this very topic. And it's a topic around deprescribing and polypharmacy. And what does that look like? You know, knowing that polypharmacy exists, but what do you do about it? And I think in the past several years, it's really gained a lot of steam in a couple of domains. I think from the pharmacy lens, there's a group, right, that is talking about the role of pharmacists, not just deprescribing, but starting medications. There's actually an entire organization dedicated to deprescribing now, not just cardiovascular wise, but the whole focus is developing literature and policy and things. And if you're not aware, the actual federal government has taken interest in deprescribing, and CMS has recently announced some billing codes, including identifying pharmacists as clinicians in those billing codes for deprescribing. So I don't think, Rob, when you set out to do this paper, this landscape was going to be such a hot, timely topic, right? And now here we are. So,
yeah, when you know this came about from the clinical pharmacology committee from the AHA, and you know, for me, there's a little bit of a personal slant to it. My father was hospitalized about 2 years ago as a result of polypharmacy, frankly. And it really I took it a heightened interest as part of that. But, you know, as you kind of think about how guidelines have developed and, you know, patients with multimorbidity, the guidelines call for multiple meds stacked on top of each other. It's very easy to get into this polypharmacy realm, if you will. And that doesn't include thinking about meds that maybe don't belong there. And that's kind of what stimulated this idea. And, you know, it's only taken on more steam and I think more prominence since we started, developing this idea.
Yeah. And it's interesting, even, you know, the New York Times and other have covered recently this whole conversation around deprescribing. And, you know, I think there is broadly, and not just in the cardiovascular domains, there's a lot of good things about the concept of deprescribing. I think there is a lot of challenges still and things to think through and what we're looking at. And, you know, and we'll get into this all in the point of the conversation. So I don't want to jump straight into this. So, you know, if you aren't aware, we'll try to attach this. The article that the scientific statement, it's very awesome, is called Deprescribing in Patients with Cardiovascular Disease Experiencing Polypharmacy. And it's a scientific statement from the American Heart Association. So Rob, I guess maybe let's start setting the stage and really talk about this. Is I think this is where debate sometimes comes in, is what is polypharmacy, right? So what is the definition of polypharmacy and what does that mean? And maybe if you can elucidate, because I always try to put this in terms with patient that there's good polypharmacy and there's bad polypharmacy, right? So if you want to kind of what you guys kind of led into and how prevalent is polypharmacy based on what definition you use, right? So
Yeah, on the sort of the highest level or the kind of the basic level, polypharmacy itself is generally defined as a patient being prescribed or taking five or more medications. And that includes both prescription and non-prescription. And I think it's the latter that we often forget about or may neglect, whether it be the clinician or the patient. There's also a term hyper polypharmacy, which there's different definitions, but I think the most standard one is 10 or more medications. And so, as you allude to, just simply the number alone may not be a bad thing, right? If it depending on the patient's risk makeup and prognosis for their disease and age and things like that. Where the problem comes in is when that polypharmacy or hyper polypharmacy is or involves the use of maybe inappropriate prescribing. And this isn't to necessarily point the finger to say that somebody's doing something wrong, but oftentimes we prescribe medications and we don't peel them back if they're not effective, if their expiry or their indication has expired, or they're having adverse events. And that's really kind of the focus of what, we wanted to try to highlight in this paper, is trying to have a patient-centered focus and individualized approach, but within a little bit of a structure to guide people.
Yeah, and I think this is an interesting piece and construct because I like what you're saying, and I think, or I hope you get into this. I think the reason we end up with polypharmacy is, like everything in healthcare, multifactorial. I often think, to your point about stuff that gets started and never stopped. I working in cardiology, you often see people come post CT surgery and they've been put on amiodarone. I've had this happen more times than I've ever want to experience in my life. Post CT surgery on amiodarone for AFib prevention, CT surgery sees them very quickly after follow-up, but then releases them, and they may not immediately get into cardiology, and they may stay with primary care, and then primary care is afraid to stop. And the next thing you know, you have someone on amiodarone for like months to years for no reason, right? Because no one has asked the question.
And then they
So,
end up on Synthroid and all that
right.
other stuff, right? And so, like, it sort of compounds. You get these prescribing cascades. You'd asked about the prevalence. It's there's various estimates, but in patients with cardiovascular disease, it's probably close to 60% of patients experience experience polypharmacy using that five or more medication definition. And when you drill down to some of the other, cardiovascular diseases like heart failure, it could be more like three quarters of them or even higher, depending on the data set you look at. So it is a very common problem, or it's a very common thing to experience. Whether it's a problem requires investigation by the clinician and things like that.
Well, and I think to your point, the funny part about this is the reason it exists is also multifactorial, right? And you think about heart failure, and you alluded to that. I mean, heart failure at this point, by default, you are going to be in a realm of polypharmacy just by having the diagnosis alone. That doesn't include your other diagnoses or anything else to that. And that's where I have to tell patients about good polypharmacy and bad polypharmacy. And even people who think, oh, I'm not taking one pill, it's a poly pill. Well, really, you're still doing polypharmacy because you have two different agents in there from that. And that makes it a different that, in the hypertension realm. But then what happens is we're at our own fault in terms of, in my mind, part of this is the way scientific development of evidence works is we never go back and test. Now that we have this strategy, do we need to have this strategy? And you see that a little now, and I think the best example is the beta blockers that you've talked about, post MI, and what do we do with this now that we've gotten better at PCI. But I don't think that's occurring broadly, and that's not just a problem in the cardiovascular space. The New York Times article I was referring to, and not to there's been a lot of talks about antidepressants and what is the need for them, and so forth. They're not saying good or bad or the other. This is just a commentary that exists based on our health secretary's conversations. But The question they brought up that is a valid question is like some of these things were only studied for X a period of time, and we don't know, did we need to be on, or have you changed? And that same thing happens in cardiology. We don't sometimes know the long-term benefits of all these things, or if there's things that need to change, has evolution changes, or disease state management changes. We're at the mercy of that's a part of it, right? So.
Yeah, exactly. The other thing is I think most of us focus on adults, right? Because that's who we see. But this is also an issue in children. And that was one of the things that we tried to highlight in our statement as well. The incidents, the outcomes, the problems are very similar, but it often gets overlooked because the focus has been largely on adults and particularly older adults. So I think it's very it's a very important thing to highlight. It's a difficult thing to tackle, though.
Well, and then I think on top of out of that, then it highlights just the healthcare system challenges as a whole in terms of transitional care and communications and coordination, prescribing practices, because people get thinking about metrics. And you mentioned this in the good old fashioned as a pharmacist, the automated filling systems, the things that were supposed to be so helpful for patients, but also at the same time create problems, right? And so it really is, what is that balance that you create something that's useful but doesn't induce a new type of problem? So jumping in, what did you all kind of outline and hash? Like, so what did you describe, obviously polypharmacy being the problem? What did you indicate being, so we know polypharmacy exists, what kind of outcomes did you see in the CV space for things that are kind of either those common agents or cascades or things that are appear to be big problems that people need to be aware of?
Yeah, so I mean, our approach, excuse me, was to highlight one the prevalence to show how often this occurs, but secondarily try to demonstrate from the literature what polypharmacy has been associated with, and it's usually negative things, right? Depend particularly in the cardiovascular literature, polypharmacy has been associated with adverse clinical outcomes. Poor prescribing of guideline-directed medical therapy for the various diseases, increased in healthcare utilization like hospitalizations, increase in cost, things like that. So it's not just a numbers problem. It adds to complexity, but it also has been associated with poorer outcomes in patients with it. One of the biggest things is that it really contributes to non-adherence among patients. And so, if they don't take their meds, they're not going to have as beneficial effect. And so it has a lot of potential downstream effects. The challenge, and we've talked a little bit about this already, is that the data that exists is not as robust as we probably need it to be. And perhaps we'll talk about that later, but that's one of the challenges that I think we face as it relates to deprescribing is that we probably need a little bit more robust data to support the different approaches and both the efficacy and safety.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely a good place to transition is, and just to summarize, we definitely know that even when there's good polypharmacy, there can be adverse events that are tied to it, depending on how this occurs, and that there's a balance there. But even in that, to your point, there are probably agents and things that need to be evaluated. And I think hypertension is probably the best example I can think of, because a lot of times people use what I call the second line agents sometimes to manage hypertension, and if could we do something different, or what does that look like? Or now that there may be non-medication strategies to help, such as renal denervation or something to that effect, we clearly have to evaluate strategies. And the funny thing, and this is kind of related to polypharmacy, but it's a question I have fundamentally as we get more and more injectable agents, and like, how many injections are people going to be willing to take, right? Like in injecting themselves with things, because that's a different type of question related to polypharmacy. It's not even about like what are the side effects, but it's like, how many injections are people willing to inject themselves with? It's a
Well,
fundamental question.
it's a very contemporary thing, right? Because some of these injectables may only be given in the clinic setting, and they may only need to be given monthly or quarterly or something along those lines. And so there's this balance, right? frequency versus sort of comfort, discomfort, that kind of thing, as well as potentially cost, right? And so we actually allude to that a little bit in this statement to say that we don't know what impact some of these things may have. It may actually be beneficial from a polypharmacy perspective and adherence, but we, you know, it remains to be seen.
What you're already classing up or setting up, excuse me, I don't know why I'm saying class, what you're setting up is we, and this is broadly beyond CV, and this is a little bit of the conversation. I think everyone is supportive of this. I don't think there's any question, no matter what Campion. I think there needs to be more research and evidence to built around deprescribing and what to do, and maybe looking at our research paradigm differently. And I think that's something everyone can agree on, no matter what camp you're in, about therapeutic, is that we clearly have a lot of work to do in understanding how to make regimens less complex, but also understand, does it change outcomes or what does it look like? And I think that that's what I love about hearing about this deprescribing group or society. They're coming up with it and people are starting to study it. And there's actually several people prolifically. There's some great physicians that are really bought into deprescribing in the CV space and are doing work around that to
It's really an
understand.
international issue. I mean, this is something, if you look like the deprescribing networks, there's several in the US, but they're multicultural, multinational. Most major countries actually have some version of their own deprescribing network. So yeah, there's a lot of energy and resources being devoted to trying to tackle this problem.
All right. And I think the other one other thing I want to make, you mentioned kids, but I think the other thing on the flip side, deprescribing definitely becomes a thing in elderly and or those in palliative care situations, which I think to me, the palliative care community, or maybe the elderly or end of life, it's a little bit easy. I don't want to say it's super easier, but it's a little bit easier to wrap your mind around when we need to deprescribe or look at things. From that standpoint, and to me, a lot of literature has been done in that space, or at least evaluated from that standpoint.
Yeah, and so that's why we wanted to take the approach of looking at it more broadly, right? So people who aren't end of life, perhaps middle-aged, and how do you approach that person and compare that to how you approach deprescribing in a child with cardiovascular disease and the complexities of that, dealing with not only the child but the parents or caregivers. And so you know that it becomes a lot more complicated and perhaps a little bit more nuanced when you're talking about those folks as opposed to somebody who may be palliative or end of life.
Okay. Sorry. I think we've set it all up. So, you know, obviously you alluded to, we don't have a ton of literature at this particular juncture. Kind of what the answer to polypharmacy is deprescribing in theory, or one of the solutions of that is deprescribing. So what is deprescribing and what are kind of, maybe if you want to outline the general approaches or strategies today that we can think of to really start doing this.
You know, the one thing that I would sort of frame it as is deprescribing is part of optimal prescribing, and maybe deprescribing itself gets a bad rap because of that. And I think the focus should be on optimal prescribing, and that includes making sure they're on the right meds and getting them off the perhaps the things that may not be benefiting them. So there are a couple different approaches. Generally speaking, we speak to the kind of the domain approach a little bit. There's several folks in the cardiovascular community have touched on this, particularly as it relates to geriatric care, looking at the domain approach. And then there's been a couple of different frameworks that have been proposed, the 4 M's, the 5 M's, again, that are a little bit more focused towards geriatric care, but I think can be applied globally to other adults as well as to children. You know, care coordination, having a structured approach is certainly one of the biggest things. But you know, in terms of kind of a stepwise approach, this is what we try to outline both in the text and with the figure. I think the first thing is to really try to identify patients who are candidates for deprescribing. And you know, we outline a couple of kind of categories of patients that would be triggers. One would be somebody who is experiencing an adverse drug event, and that certainly requires investigation and consideration for deprescribing. The other is simply polypharmacy. You know, if they're on 5 to 10 or more medications, you know, that person requires a little bit closer evaluation to see if there are candidates for it. The third category is prescribing cascades, and this is often kind of ADEs or adverse drug events that are overlooked, and simply the response to that is to prescribe more medications to treat the adverse event. And so, if somebody's experiencing a prescribing cascade, that may be you know, a target. And actually, as it relates to prescribing cascades, there's several cardiovascular meds that have been associated with those, diuretics, beta blockers, things like that. And then the last category is, you know, you mentioned earlier, is those that are receiving palliative or end-of-life care. You know, the most basic thing that I think we can do as far as maybe identifying some of these trends in placing people in those one of those four buckets is simply medication reconciliation. And I say simply in quotes because it's often not a simple process. You know, these medical regimens are complex. The patients may be confused. There's multiple providers, there's multiple pharmacies. And so, getting at the root of what they're actually taking, including the over-the-counter medications, you know, making sure that that's an accurate assessment of what they're on, and then making the clinical assessments about whether each of those medications is appropriate, is really the starting point for a lot of this stuff. You know, and then in the paper itself, you know, we talk about and allude to several tools that have been developed. There's dozens of tools that have been developed to assist clinicians in identifying meds that may be potentially inappropriate, or what we call potentially inappropriate meds or PIMs. You know, most people are probably familiar with the American Geriatric Society BEARS criteria. There's also the stop-start criteria and several other tools that exist that may help clinicians. They're not meant to be, you know, prescriptive in that sense, but they're aids to help with that assessment of whether or not a medication may or may not be appropriate for that patient. And so, in the paper, we have a table that really outlines several of these and categorizes them based on how they're, you know, how they're structured, what their focus is. Some of them are broad-based, some of them are very specific to a disease or a particular risk. There's also a couple that are specific to children. And so we try to outline that and give folks some tools that they may refer to.
Regarding the outline of the tools, you didn't land on a specific tool as one being better than the other. You really kind of allude to these are some tools and you can kind of use them as a framework. I think the best way to describe some of these things are frameworks, right? And at least to guide conversation or think about starting point at this juncture. Is that your opinion or assessment?
Yeah, and a lot of that relates to just the you know, the limits of the evidence that exists currently. You know, most of the tools are categorized as either explicit, where it's very specific criteria for whether or not that drug is appropriate or not, or implicit, where there's some rules in place to determine whether it's appropriate, but it also requires some clinical judgment or perhaps some patient-specific data. There's also been another kind of categorization that's maybe not as well known, where it kind of talks specifically about how the drug listing or drug-oriented listing is categorized. So, is it simply a drug list that doesn't require any knowledge of the patient? Is it a drug list that's associated with an indication? Things like, you know, the BEARS criteria kind of fit in that mold. As do the stop-start criteria. And then there's another listing approach called the patient in focus listing approach. And so there is some evidence that suggests that those latter, the patient in focus listing approaches, may be associated with better outcomes. But the data supporting that is limited. You know, and so something like the Fit for Aged, which is a European It's used largely in Europe or advocated for in Europe is an example of the latter.
What is so you have a framework, you have things you consider. What are the ways that you kind of recommend people if they're wanting to think about integrating this into their practice? Or, and we're going to kind of talk to, or maybe we could talk about now, like clearly I alluded that CMS is now going to bill and allow people to work on deprescribing as a part of their process. I don't know if how much you know about that and want to explain to it. I know if you're interested, the American College of Clinical Pharmacy and American Society of Health has some information about it. It's all incident to billing, and depending on how that is structured, it could be beneficial or not, or fruitful. It's tricky to do some of that work if you know anything about billing, and depending on how much juice is worth the squeeze to do that process. But if someone's interested in doing this, what is their process for how to think about this?
So I think, one of the important things is that this is not something that you can just do on a whim. I think it requires a structured process, which I think many interdisciplinary committees or clinic, not committees, but interdisciplinary clinics and programs have that structure in place. And so we talk about making sure that you're leveraging the entire team, including pharmacists and nurses and others. That may be able to help with this. One of the important things about deprescribing is, and we address this in the paper, we have some examples in a table, is that, some of the medications may require tapering, while others you can simply stop. And the reason for kind of assessing that and taking a structured approach to that is that when you stop or taper these medications, patients may experience adverse drug withdrawal events or AW or ADWEs. And having individuals or team members in place that can help monitor for that stuff, I think, is really important. And that I think feeds into some of the billing things that you're alluding to. And in the statement, we talk about challenges moving forward, and one of them is having distinct billing mechanisms for deprescribing. And so, as the paper was going through its final stages for publication, as you mentioned, the federal government in the first week of May actually, really tried to empower and highlight the potential for billing for deprescribing services, and I'm not going to pretend that I'm a billing expert on this, but they outline several current CPT codes that you may bill under, or you may be able to get reimbursed for deprescribing. And those include chronic care management or CCM, principal care management or PCM. And then there's also a couple that are more specific for behavioral health and psychiatric comprehensive medication management, behavioral health integration management codes, as well as the psychiatric collaborative care management codes. And so I think this really gives it one, it addresses one of the partially addresses one of the challenges we talk about. But it does give clinician groups and clinics and providers a mechanism to get reimbursed for this important activity, because it can be very time consuming, and when you're factoring that in among all the other things that are being asked of clinicians in a short period of time in an office visit, I think for some of those reasons, deprescribing often gets put on the back burner. And so now, if there's a little bit of an incentive or at least a reimbursement mechanism for it, perhaps individual groups or physician groups, clinics will take advantage of this, and your time will be paid for. Again, if the, as you mentioned, the juice is worth the squeeze, that's where I have to plead the fifth, because I can't speak to the all the details about the billing side of things, but.
It's very complex, and there's lots of things to consider, and especially with incident two. And I've talked to a variety of different people about this in different areas and parts of the country. And it's not that people aren't interested in exploring it and not taking the opportunity, but I think some people have realized that it may not be they're not banking on it to revolutionize what they're getting for reimbursement, or you know, it's not that the acknowledgement isn't good. It's just it may not be everything. You have to still have other means and ways to generate revenue to some extent. It's not going to you can't stand up on it on its own, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
So,
right. The reimbursement you get is not going to support a clinic by itself or a
correct.
provider by itself, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And so it's supplementary to what you may be doing. So Rob, kind of what are the things that we need to do still? Oh, actually, one more question before we get to that, actually. I think the most important part too that you put into this paper, and I think this is important everywhere, especially in the CV space, talk about how you engage the patient and think about shared decision making.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a critical component of this. We can, you know, say, hey, you need to do this, you need to do that, but the patient and or the caregiver, depending on, you know, where they're at in the spectrum of things, engaging them is an important initial step once you've identified the patient and perhaps the medications to consider deprescribing. To do it without their consent may enlist some distrust. If you're suggesting, you know, somebody prescribed this medication, perhaps you or another provider, and now you're saying you need to take it away, that can create some distrust among the patient, the caregiver, and you know, various providers. And so, you know, framing it from that perspective, getting their input, clarifying what their goals of care are and the reason why you may be considering deprescribing, I think are all very important things. While, you know, we talk about any clinician on the team should be empowered to start that conversation, it should probably be initiated by, or the process of deprescribing and considering it with that patient should probably be initiated by the physician, who's leading that particular clinic or caring for that patient. And that now that decision may enlist then the assistance of other team members to help with the process. But it's a it, to me, I think it's a really important thing to do. And you know, there is some literature to suggest that if, you know, if when you ask patients, if your physician were to ask or suggest this, would you be willing to do it? Generally speaking, most people are okay with it as long as they're, you know, you explain well why you're doing it and what the potential benefits are and how you're going to follow them, right? If they're concerned, well, I'm worried that my disease is going to get worse. You know, my AFib is going to come back. I'm going to have a heart attack or whatever. Explaining to them, you know, what the likelihood is of those things and how you're going to try to mitigate that through monitoring or tapering or all of the above, I think is an important part of this. So yeah, shared decision making is critically important.
What are the gaps and what do we need to do? What do you think is underway? What do you think the next steps and stages are? How do you encourage pharmacists to either think about this as research or to start doing this in practice? I know we alluded a little bit about practice from that. So what is your takeaway
Yeah, I mean, I
or next
think,
step?
you know, we outlined some action items, and many of which we've already sort of talked about. In terms of things that we still maybe don't know or that we need, you know, we talk about the need and we kind of addressed it already, but there is a need for more robust, high quality evidence on, you know, on several things. I think really the deprescribing, first and foremost, is safety and effectiveness of it, you know. What's the rate of adverse drug withdrawal events? What's the rate of kind of rebound events related to the disease? You know, that medication was treating. What's the best sort of structured approach, or who's the right provider or providers, plural, to include as part of that process? So we do need better studies, and there are things that are ongoing. You know, some members of our writing team are involved in a lot of this research. Implementation science is certainly a framework. There's N of one trials that are ongoing, but we need more I think we need more data for sure. We talked about the reimbursement mechanisms, excuse me. And so while the policy changes in May are maybe a step in the right direction, perhaps we need to go further and have some that are specifically dedicated to deprescribing. But I think that's certainly a step in the right direction. And then the last thing that we touched on that I think maybe overlooked is that this concept of polypharmacy and deprescribing is generally speaking not addressed in the curricula of most health professions, medicine, pharmacy, nursing. And so, we kind of challenge those disciplines and their accrediting bodies to maybe consider including some content related to this and its importance and maybe how to approach it. So that it is on, people's radar screens and that we have a little bit more of a structure in place to do so.
Okay, very good. I think this has been a great conversation. Any final thoughts or closing aspects to this conversation?
I'm glad that the American Heart Association gave us the license to pursue this. And I'm pleased to see that it's published in circulation so that it gets a little bit more, hopefully it gets a little bit more traction and puts it on people's radar screens. It's meant as a, it's a scientific statement. It's meant to kind of stimulate some thought and provide some structure. And hopefully people can find that the tools that we provide and the summaries that we provide are useful.
Rob, final question I don't want to ask people. Any good movies, TV shows, or books that you're reading or anything this summer or?
So, it's interesting as part of my work on the ACCP Board of Regents, we're actually reading a book on leadership that I think is really cool. There's a whole series of things from Collins as the author and I think the work has, it's actually been kind of interesting for me, just because I'm not somebody who's, I have some leadership roles and have been in leadership roles, but I can't say that I've read a lot about leadership. And so it's been interesting to kind of think through some of that stuff and, and learn and grow through the process. So.
Very good. All right, Rob, thank you. And as always, if people want to find you, I think they can find you on LinkedIn as the last thing. And I think you're on X still. If you have any other comments or questions for Rob, you can certainly reach out to him. I think he has the vice chair of the author. His email is also there in the area where you can communicate with the author. Thank you so much for taking the time, Rob, for being here and going through this important scientific statement. I think it's a great addition. I think it'll be interesting for you to follow along the journey or the team to follow along in the journey and see how this continues to develop. I bet you in a couple of years you could probably write a different version of this statement because to the point there is going to be a lot of developments to this whole space. You know what I mean? So I think it'll be a topic that will continue to be timely, especially as people think about this. And really, it could help think about translational implementation research as we go forth. And what does that
Yeah,
look like?
agreed.
All right.
Thanks for the invitation, Craig.
Yep. Thank you for your time. And I hope everybody enjoyed this episode. As always, if you like, subscribe, comment, provide feedback, we really do appreciate it. And I thank you all for listening in. Until next time, we'll be joined with another guest. Have a great one. Thank you.